The committee of the whole, please come to order. The next bill for our consideration is House Bill 46. The reading clerk will read the bill.
House Bill 46, introduced by Representative Stubson, an act relating to campaign funds. This bill was referred to Committee Number 7, Corporations, Elections, and Political Subdivisions, which recommended it do pass with amendments. Ayes, Blickery, Byrd, Illoway, Yeagy, Croker, Patton, Roscoe, Shepperson, Stubson. Signed, Representative Illoway, Chairman.
Vice Chair Stubson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I would move House Bill when the Committee of the Whole rises to report it, do so with the recommendation that House Bill 46 do pass, and I would further amend the Standing Committee Amendment Number 1, and I would turn over the explanation of the bill to the good representative from House District 56. And Mr. Chairman,
Representative Stubson,
with the explanation of the bill. Ladies and gentlemen, I bring the bill before you. It's interesting as we've been looking through this bill. I've had several people pull me over in the halls and ask me who is this getting at? What issue brought this up, and why are we talking about it? And so I wanted to explain a little bit about the genesis of the bill. And it goes back about a year and a half or so when I was a week-long period where I heard of two instances in different states where those who were serving, I believe it was in the legislatures of both states, had taken their campaign funds and used them for their own personal benefit. And in one circumstance, I think the gentleman built a nice addition onto his house. In another circumstance, it was a woman who invested some of her campaign funds into her struggling business. And what struck me was not so much the conduct itself as the reaction to that conduct. And there were several interviews of these people's constituents. And what was clear was that that conduct had reinforced within these people's minds that politics was not a matter of public service, but it was a matter of self-service. And you could see a significant, building of the questioning of our institutions and how we govern ourselves. And so I actually ran back and I looked in our statutes to see what sort of limits do we have on the way we spend campaign funds. And I was actually surprised to find out that there are absolutely no limits whatsoever in law in how we spend our campaign funds. In fact, I could build that addition on my house, or I could invest it in my business, or I could take my family to Disneyland or to a resort area, and it would be no problem under our current laws. And as I started talking to constituents about it and other folks, this seemed to defy a little bit of common sense and defy certainly the expectations of what people had when they were giving me campaign funds, and I'm certain when they were giving you campaign funds as well. And so the other great concern that arises is that, as we all know, we have limits on gifts in this body, and we can't receive gifts from others as a result of our legislative service above that $250 threshold. What our current law allows us to do is it allows essentially the right hand to do what the left hand cannot, because you can certainly envision a scenario where instead of gifts being given directly to you, they are funneled into your campaign funds, and then when you decide not to run, after you've built up a heavy war chest, you can use those for any purpose that you deem appropriate. And so it really seemed to be an end around around our ethics laws and that govern this body, at least. And so the bill before you is fairly simple in nature, and I structured it to be very flexible and to allow us to do with our campaign funds what probably most of us are doing with them now, which is A, allow us to use them to get elected, and B, allow us to use them in the furtherance of our duties as public servants. And the only thing it prohibits is the use of campaign funds for personal benefit. And that term is not spelled out, in a laundry list of things, But it does include reference to the IRS code and the way we would treat monies given to us as income under the IRS code. It also includes the defraying of your normal living expenses and the expenses of your immediate family. So the other thing the bill does is that it gives us some direction on what we do with these funds after we're done running for office. And currently, there's no direction whatsoever in law. But what this says is you can hold on to your funds after your last election. You can hold on to those funds for 8 years. So if you think you may run again after you leave this body for a county commissioner or whatever, you can hold on to those funds in anticipation of doing that. But at the end of those 8 years, you would need to distribute those funds, and it gives you a laundry list of avenues to do that. And you can do that. You can give them to charity. I'm sure many in this body would want to donate them back to the general fund. You can give them to universities or colleges. You can give them to other candidates. Yeah, I mean, there's a number of things you can do with them, but you just can't use them for your own personal gain. The bill does not set up any onerous reporting requirements. The reporting requirements we have under law for our campaign funds remain exactly the same. But what this does do is it establishes a standard in law that we can all look at and we can all govern ourselves by. It sets a common sense standard that I think those who give us money expect us to live by anyway. And I think gives us grounds to be able to protect the integrity of this body and to be able to protect the reputation of this body, which I think is one of those duties that we're all elected to do. And with that general explanation of the bill, I would proceed to Standing Committee Amendment Number 1. And there were just a couple of changes, and these are changes in how you can distribute your funds after you've decided to liquidate that campaign account. And the changes were really to give you more flexibility. Instead of designating just a 501c3 organization, it would be any organization qualified under 501c. And then there was, instead of requiring the donation of funds to the state university and Wyoming community colleges, being I'm an alumni of the institution over the hill, I thought was a good idea. Instead, this allows you to donate to any university or community college, or college. So with that, I would go ahead and take the question on the bill Standing Committee Amendment unless there's any specific questions on the Standing Committee Amendment.
Chairman Brown.
Well, Mr. Chairman, I haven't done the tax research. I don't want to do the tax research. I don't like tax research. But I really question lines 22 and 23. It says that campaign funds cannot be put to any use that would require the amount to be treated as an amount of as gross income under Section 61 of the United States Internal Revenue Code. Now that would be, that's a level above adjusted gross income. And so it would not permit the use of those funds for anything that either was deductible in arriving at adjusted gross income nor anything that was deductible as an expense. And so my question for the sponsor is, has that tax research been done, and can you explain to us why you want to go to the clear to the top number, and if it counts as income under Part 61, it can't, then it prohibits that use.
Representative Stubson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. That provision is based after a number of other provisions that are found in other state laws of a similar sort to this. I don't totally understand the question. I didn't totally understand it. But really, you're talking about, if you're offsetting expenses, particularly expenses of your service, expenses of the campaign, those aren't going to be treated as gross income under the code, and those wouldn't count as gross income under the code. I don't know that gets to the question, but if you're talking about the appropriate use of these funds is in furtherance of your duties and in furtherance of your campaign, then I think that provision of the IRS code actually gets to the nub of the issue.
Chairman Childers.
Well, Mr. Chairman, What about payment for the various organizations that we're involved in? And basically, I've always used them for education purposes. They may be contributed by the by the very companies that support you, and then you turn right around and join those organizations. That in particular, I'd be curious how those would be handled under this bill. And then also, a number of us have gone in and basically purchased the lamb from the stock show and donated it to the Senior Citizen Center. That's in some ways not furthering towards your business, but I mean towards you being a legislator. The senior citizens really like the meat, and it pays somebody in 4-H or whatever. So either one of those, I personally don't see a real problem with doing that. But tell me what this bill does with that.
Representative Stepson.
Mr. Chairman, before I answer the question, if there's no other questions on the amendment, can I call for the question on the standing committee amendment?
Question being called. All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, no. The amendment passes. We're back on the bill. Representative Stepson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And I'll answer that question, and I know there's a committee of the whole amendment we need to address as well. Chairman raises some good issues, and I think they zero in on why this bill is so flexible and is created in the way that it is. Certainly paying to go on to different organizations to learn about public issues is in furtherance of your duties as a public servant, and that certainly would qualify for expenditure under this bill. I don't see any way, shape, or form that you can argue that it doesn't. Purchasing items and then donating them to charity, again, the only thing this precludes is converting those funds to personal use. That, again, as defined in little I, little 2, and little 3, I don't think even arguably considered as being converted to personal use. And I think there's also an argument that given the number of things that we buy to give away to charity, it functions and those sorts of things, those are in furtherance of our duties as legislators. So both of those instances raised show why this is flexibly written and would be permitted under this bill.
Mr. Speaker.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. If you would like, I can move and will move Committee of the Whole Amendment Number 1 to House Bill 46 so we can consider that quickly as well and then probably have more debate on the actual substance of the bill. This proposed amendment, I'm not sure how exactly I feel about the legislation overall except to say that although there may not have been a specific occurrence that was the genesis or catalyst for this piece of legislation, it seems to me that with this we might call into question past uses of campaign contributions. And because this bill calls for a criminal penalty, which looks to me to be some kind of hybrid high misdemeanor, it calls for up to 6 months in jail or a fine of not more than $1,000, I thought it might be appropriate to basically limit this bill to apply only to those contributions received after July 1st, 2011 by a candidate or a candidate's campaign committee. You can look on page 4, line 17 is where this committee of the whole amendment applies. That way, we're all kind of on an even playing field starting out if we indeed do pass this legislation and it becomes law. It'll apply prospectively July 1st, 2011. Not only will it be the law, but it will apply only to those campaign funds that are received after that date. And then that kind of takes away any question there may be regarding, the uses of these funds for the last 20 or 30 years. So that's the amendment, and I stand for any questions on that.
Any further discussion on the committee of whole amendment one? Question being called. All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, no.
No.
The amendment passes. We're back on the bill. Is there any further, Mr. Majority Whip?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Rising on and against the bill, and I understand that we want transparency and we want everybody to do what's right all the time, but we, in my opinion, police ourselves quite well. We are reported to, we report and report and report in this body to the point where it is onerous, in my opinion. If you want to look at the state to the south of us, they have restricted what they can do in their body to the point where they can't even take a cup of coffee. And we have done a good job, in my opinion, of policing ourselves in the past. There's lots of light that shines on the way you spend every dollar out of that campaign account. And I just don't see the necessity of this bill.
Representative Nicholas.
To the sponsor of the bill, I just have a question. If you loan money to your campaign, either in a prior campaign or, in a primary or then a general, does this prevent you from repaying back funds that have been commingled into the account?
Representative Stubson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. To answer that last question first, a loan is not a contribution. A loan is a loan. And so this wouldn't impact at all the repayments of loans that you make to your campaign. In answer to a couple of the issues, there was a reference to the penalties that are included in the bill. These are the identical penalties that we all face right now if we violate any provision within the election code. So this is nothing new, nothing strange. This is what we all face when we file our reports today and have for many years. So that shouldn't be anything that causes fright through the body. And there was some discussion about reporting, and again, this bill does nothing about reporting. We do have done a great job about increasing the amount of reporting and the transparency that we have to our voters. But what we don't do, there was a discussion about we police ourselves, but based on what standard? There is no standard in law right now. How are we supposed to police ourselves if we can use money for whatever purpose that we so choose? This bill is not about anything else other than setting a standard, a minimum standard, that all of our constituents expect us to live up to anyway. And so don't sort of lose the forest for the trees, because if you want to police yourselves, first you have to have a standard. So if we really want to stand up and say, yes, we police ourselves, let's at least have a minimum standard.
Representative Patton.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I voted for this in committee, and so I just if anybody was paying any attention, I voted no on the amendment, and I just want to make sure that the proponent of the bill understands that when we eliminated to the state university, meaning University of Wyoming, and then we had the audacity to strike the Wyoming community colleges, I just thought that was a terrible thing to do. But in reality, that, you know, I guess that's okay because I can still contribute to them and will. The one thing, and this is really serious, on page 3, line 1, a candidate or candidate's campaign committee shall dispose of all campaign funds within 8 years after the latter date of. And I don't know what I should do. It was 32 years from my last campaign before I got in this one. So I don't know whether 8 years is fair or not. But please consider something, personal like that. Thank you.
Representative Branish.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. So one thing I'd like to reflect, I was always told you're supposed to get up here, but, you know, it's a lot easier to talk back there because you're not all looking at me, So I'm rising against this bill and for several reasons. First off, you know, we talk about any money received after July of 2011. How do we know which dollars are which? You know, if we happen to have some campaign funds, is it first in, first out, last in, first out, or what? But more importantly, it's my understanding that these campaign funds are treated by the IRS as a gift. And it's not, and I think we all want to be responsible. We're not looking at ways to enrich ourselves personally. But I think we're striving too hard in this particular case. And, I spent a lot of money on campaigns, and I lost a lot of money on campaigns, and I ran for a lot of offices and never paid a salary, and I never collected a salary. And so I'm not looking to enrich myself, and that's for darn sure. But I think we're trying too hard, and I think we're trying to go against the IRS right now. I think considers all campaign contributions as a gift. And I like the way it's kind of been. Thank you. I'm against the bill.
Representative Peterson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I rise in opposition to this proposed piece of legislation. Each one of us on this floor, when we ran in the general election and in the primary in 2011, had to fill out various reports that we filed with the state of Wyoming. That disclosed what our expenditures were, what our campaign contributions were, and that, I think, gives everybody an idea of what was happening. That gives complete visibility to anyone that wants to look at this. You have several things here. There's affirmative burdens that's being placed upon you. And here's the problem. I do not see really where you have to file a report type situation beyond what we did in 2011 for a period of 8 years. We're reaching out. And some of us may have forgetful experiences. Some of us may not see where this is at. You'd have to make a complete accounting of this. Did I spend the funds on my constituents, on the travel, the numerous meetings, the night meetings, things that I've gone to, whatever's gone forward? And then the final element I'd like to point out, I submit to the body that it's getting more and more difficult to find people that will take and change their lives and come forward and serve in these various bodies. And if you start putting onerous burdens on them above and beyond this, I think we are headed for a bad problem. And the final thing, in the 10 years that I have been here, I have not been made aware of anything whereby people have not used their funds in an appropriate manner. So I'd certainly rise in opposition to this bill.
Chairman Lockhart.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I have a specific question. And my reading of page 1, contributions received by a candidate or candidate's campaign committee shall only be expended for purposes directly related to promoting the nomination or election of a candidate. And I may have violated that in the past, because in the central part of the state, there's a county organization that requests your attendance at things, and usually there's a contribution that's there, and I've used campaign funds for that. And that isn't, in my mind, election of a candidate. It's support of a party that's consistent with your candidacy. And so would that be not allowed under this bill as drafted?
Representative Greer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I am generally in favor of the bill. I like the guidance that it provides. I must say that I like the amendment for the Committee of the Whole, did not like the Standing Committee amendment. But one thing I would like to point out, the gentleman from District 14 aptly points out some concerns with the Internal Revenue Code. Section 61 of the code generally, an overview provides all income from whatever source derived unless accepted out. Interest is clearly included in that. So I do like what this bill is doing. However, if it moves forward, I would be bringing a second amendment or second reading amendment to delete out subsection B Romanet 3, as I can see that causing some problems down the road. Overall, I like the guidance that it brings. I really do.
Representative Yagi.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just something of information for all of us. This is campaign funds personal use, and it's not talking about just legislators. This is talking about any elected person in the state, so we need to consider that.
Representative Madden.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I look at this bill, and I don't see anything wrong with it, and I look at it from the standpoint of perception. And you know, if the perception is out there, or if we allow the perception to be out there that we don't have any restrictions on personal use of campaign funds, and moreover, we're not even going to change it, I think it kind of, in some people's minds, reaffirms what they think of politicians and people anyway. You know, if you took a survey of the populace and asked them, you know, what profession or what type of job is the most low life you can think of, you know, we probably aren't too far from the top of the list. You know, I know we would finish ahead of used car salesmen and bookies and things like that. And I just think that we're making an awful mistake if we vote this down. I certainly don't want to let the perception go that we can spend this money on personal use. There's probably enough people to think we're doing that already. Thank you.
Chairman McComey.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm looking at this bill, and last time this bill came, I was opposed to it. And I'm not real sure how I feel about it right now, but I don't really like it for two reasons. I'm not going to have to report anything, I guess, if I resign from the legislature or don't decide not to run again. But in the end of 8 years, who's going to be the cop that's going to come be, or who's going to be the person that's going to come run me down and make sure that I've got rid of all that money, however, whatever the amount may be? That's a question that I don't see answered in the bill, and it's got some pretty good penalties. So you'd think somebody would be wanting to run me down and find out if I'm still around, or my estate, or whatever the case may be. I'm a little concerned about that part of the bill.
Representative Dan Zwan, sir.
Thanks, Mr. Chairman. Just a question on the bill that I need clarification on. What happens if I run for the same office or higher office and I initially start out giving money of my own into my campaign account through my committee? Even if it is a loan, the way I read the bill is I can't get that money back once I file in the primary, even if I have a lot of donations coming in the general. And under this bill, does that allow me to get the money I put into my campaign back out once I file it? And if someone can answer that, that'd be great.
Chairman Korberg.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Chairman, I'm inclined to be a no vote on this bill. And I guess part of it is, as you're out there campaigning, any constituent can ask you, how are you spending your funds? What did you do with your campaign funds? It's okay to give some guidance, I think, but certainly those, I would imagine, those individuals who are not running again and who have campaign funds left over, I'm sure many of them have disposed of them in this way. So I guess I'm not really seeing, it seems like perhaps we're creating a bill for maybe a problem that doesn't really exist, that we've all not done proper things with the funds that we have left over. We don't carry them forward from year to year. My initial reaction to this bill, I have a problem with the 8 years. And then again, as one of my good colleague from Lander said, who's going to enforce it anyway? So I'm inclined to be on and against this piece of legislation. Thank you.
Chairman Childers.
Well, Mr. Chairman, if there are ethical reasons that you feel like you need to vote for this bill, that's fine. But the subject of perception was brought up, and you know, there are a number of organizations in this state that paint some of us in this organization in a manner that we're money-grubbing people, or just because I work for the minerals industry, that I don't, that I'm not a very ethical person, that I do everything that I could to pollute the atmosphere, the water, and the land, and so forth, and then possibly even the way we handle these funds. But quite frankly, I'm proud of the industry that I came from, and I'm proud of the 14 years that I've been in the legislature. And I think I brought what I learned over the 30-some-odd years in that industry. I brought that to the legislature to make better decisions for the state of Wyoming. How you vote on this piece of paper or this bill here, consider it from an ethical standpoint. But I'll be danged if I'm going to be forced into voting for a bill simply because some of these organizations feel like we aren't good people and we're spending money improperly. You use your mind to make your decision on this bill as far as from an ethic standpoint and so forth. Don't let other organizations force you into making a decision. Don't do it.
Representative Stubson.
Mr. Chairman, let me see if I can respond to some of the concerns that were raised. And I couldn't agree with the more with the speaker that just spoke. This is not about some organization pressuring. I mean, what this is about is about your relationship with your constituents and our relationship with the voters of the state of Wyoming. And we as elected officials have a responsibility to protect the trust and integrity of this institution and the public trust and trusted to us as public servants. And you can think of a circumstance, if you go back and just think, if any one of us decided to take our campaign funds, you know, not run for reelection and make our down payment on our condo in Hawaii, I mean, and that's widely publicized, what impact does that have on the institution, whether it's listed as improper or not under the statute? What impact does that have on this institution? And it fundamentally undermines, the first time it happens, the very first time it happens, it fundamentally undermines the trust that people have in this institution. And that's the importance of this bill, not that there's rampant corruption, not that there's rampant misuse of funds, but you want to prevent that first time. And how do you do it? You do it by putting a standard in law, a common sense standard that allows you to use the funds what they're intended for, which is to run for office, to promote public policy, to do your duty as a legislator or as a public official. That's common sense. That's what people expect of you when they give you the money. Ask any of your contributors. Go out and ask any single one of them, and they will tell you, they won't tell you that I gave you this money so that you can use it to pay your mortgage or buy a car or pay for your condo. They won't, I guarantee you they won't tell you that. So if that's what the expectation is, let's put it in law. If that's what we're doing, let's put it in law. Let's put a system in that protects the integrity of the institution. Now, there was the issue raised about enforcement, and it purposely did not include onerous enforcement provisions in here. Nobody's going to come knocking on your door and demand to see your bank accounts. And the reason I did that is because I knew you knew what you could expect from the legislature if you did that and tried to get this bill through. Yeah, and so what I did instead is set up a system that's flexible, that allows us to use the funds as we all expect to use them, and that sets a common sense standard in law that governs how we use those funds. I think that's a smart way to move forward. And so I'll take any further questions, but I ask you to support the bill.
I knew this moment might come, but I didn't know how I'd react. Representative Peasley.
You always react well, Mr. Chairman. And then you get out from underneath the table and move on. I came to this debate a little late, and I don't know quite how to engage. It might help if I would read the bill. The first thing I'd like to say is that I can't imagine any one of you is here for the money, and if you are, you're a fool. I think this is one of the few legislatures where it's safe to say no one really lusts after the position that we have here. And to say that it undermines the trust of the people if we don't have guidance like this, the very institutions that I think we trust least have the most regulatory requirements. And I think that's the beauty of this when there's so few. And I want to just give one little story about my frustration. I accept nothing, but I have to file multiple reports. And I got very confused because I was filing reports on computers I don't understand, and I finally just drove down and had somebody down here do it for me. And the question was asked, how much have you received in the way of contributions? And I said, zero. And then how much have you spent? Well, the first time I ran, I spent a lot of my own money. I had to run ads and stuff like that. But the second time, I didn't spend anything. But I said, I am out about $7 in return postage when I send contributions back. And how do I report that? Now, do I have to, and of course, everybody gets Twitter-pated, and we don't do anything about it. What I don't like is the concept of this long time. I've got to have another report here in January. I think there was a suggestion made by one of the questioners or whatever about a threshold. I just don't want to be hanging out for 8 years wondering. And then it makes me wonder if during this last campaign I expended my own money and then reported having received nothing, then I guess I can convert those to loans, so if I ever get into the big money contributions, I can offset those losses and gains and set up a whole bookkeeping system for my efforts at the legislature. I just don't think this is the time for this. I think every ethical issue raised by the good bringer of the bill is correct. But I'm sorry, we're still Wyoming, and I don't think any of us are going to be camping out in our offices here like they are in Washington, D.C., or we're going to be worried about groups coming in and checking. As long as we're transparent in what we do with our money, I don't think we need a lot of guidance. And if we ever do, I don't think I'm going to run for this body, because I like what we have, lay representatives and a pretty simple system. I still think it's too complicated where it is, but again, that's where it was when I came, and I don't want to be making it any more complicated. So I'm on and against whatever it is we're talking about.
Is there further Representative Stubson? I mean, Stewart. Pardon me.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Just wanted to re-ask the question about funds in our campaign committee that were donated privately, personal funds. And again, from maybe personal experience, maybe someone I know, but donated just enough to their own personal account, and at the end of the day, might have had $20 or $30 left in the checking account. Well, you look at your checking account at the end of the election and the service charge that I would be paying in the next 2 months would obliterate the remains of my personal donation to a campaign fund. And of course, if that person I'm referring to cleaned out their account so it wouldn't just disappear that money, of course that money is still saved and is in a box, a special box somewhere that person would use to campaign again. But the record keeping and the burden that would put on someone donating personal money so they could kind of push back on all of this, the ill effects of people worrying about the conflicts of donated funds. I think this puts a very high burden on someone trying to remove all of those problems.
Representative Patton.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I want to rescind my previous remarks. 32 years to make up your mind with $52 just doesn't make any sense. 8 years is probably close enough on and for the bill.
Any further discussion? Representatives, Mr. Majority Floor Leader.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I was just wondering why there wasn't any consideration in the bill for giving the money back to the people who gave it to you.
Any further discussion? Question having been called, All those in favor of Vice Chairman Stupson's motion that when the Committee of the Whole rises to the report, it do so with the recommendation that House Bill 46 do pass, please say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, no.
No.
House Bill 46 has failed Committee of the Whole. Did I hear a division? Division. All those in favor, please stand. Yeah. All those in favor, please stand. Those opposed, please stand. Having failed a standing division vote, a roll call vote is required. The chief clerk will call the roll.
Barbuto.
Aye.
Berger.
Aye.
Berger.
No.
Blake.
No.
Flickery.
Aye.
Bonner.
Aye.
Botten.
No.
Brechtel.
No.
Brown.
No.
Burkhart.
Aye.
Bird.
Aye.
Campbell.
No.
Kennedy.
No.
Childers. Connolly.
Aye.
Kraft.
No.
Davison excused. Edmonds.
No.
Eklund.
No.
Esquivel.
No.
Freeman.
No.
Gay.
No.
Gingery.
Aye.
Goggles excused. Greer.
Aye.
Green.
Aye.
Harshman.
Aye.
Harvey.
No.
Hunt.
No.
Illaway.
Aye.
Yagi.
Aye.
Kasparic.
Aye.
Croker. Crone.
No.
Lockhart.
No.
Laux.
No.
Lubno.
No.
Madden.
Aye.
McKim.
No.
McComey.
No.
Miller.
Aye.
Moniz.
No.
Nicholas.
Aye.
Patton.
No.
Patton.
Aye.
Peasley.
No.
Pedersen.
Aye.
Peterson.
No.
Petroff.
No.
Korberg. Roscoe.
Aye.
Simlick.
No.
Shepperson.
No.
Stewart.
No.
Stubson.
Aye.
Teeters.
No.
Throne.
Aye.
Vronish.
No.
Wallace.
No.
Zwanitzer Dan.
No.
Zwanitzer Dave.
No.
Mr. Speaker.
Aye.
I am about to close the vote. Are there any changes? Are there any changes? The vote is closed, 24 ayes, 34 noes, 2 excused.
Pursuant to H.R. 10-5B, House Bill 46, having failed a roll call vote, is indefinitely postponed. The next bill for our consideration is House Joint Resolution 5. The reading clerk will read the bill.
House Joint Resolution Number 5, introduced by Representative Petroff. A joint resolution proposing to amend the Wyoming Constitution to allow the legislature to provide for a procedure and laws governing unification of counties and municipalities, defining unified governments and counties for taxation and revenue purposes, and as municipalities for all other purposes, and requiring a vote. This bill was referred to Committee Number 7, Corporations, Elections, and Political Subdivisions, which recommended a do pass. Ayes, Blickery, Byrd, Illaway, Patton, Roscoe, No, Yagi, Croker, Shepperson, Stubson, signed Representative Illaway, Chairman.
You've heard the reading of the bill. What is your pleasure? Chairman Illaway.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I move that when the Committee of the Whole rises to report, it do so with a recommendation that House Joint Resolution 5 do pass, and the good representative from House District 16 will explain the bill.
Representative Petroff.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. This bill is a bill about less government. Over the past 6 years, the Corporations Committee has held at least 3 hearings about consolidation of municipalities and counties. They declared it a priority in 2008 in the interim committee, and what the issue seemed to come down to every time was a lot more questions than answers. It wasn't as much specific opposition to the idea of allowing this type of governance. It was more how do we frame it and where do we start the process. So this bill attempts to start that process, and if you'll start on page 2 of the bill, line 6, this is our Constitution, Article 14, Section 6, Consolidation of Offices. And I think this clearly demonstrates that the framers of the Wyoming Constitution intended for us to attempt consolidation whenever possible. And line 6 reads, whenever practicable, the legislature may, and whenever the same can be done without detriment to public service, shall consolidate offices in state, county, and municipalities respectively. And whenever so consolidated, the duties of such additional office shall be performed under an ex officio title. And what the paragraph immediately following would be in addition, which basically allows the legislature to establish laws governing the unification of counties and municipalities, and that it would be recognized as a county for purposes of taxation, and as a municipality for all other purposes. And then it would allow for procedures adopted by the legislature, and it would require a vote of the people in order to enact any such legislation in any counties that would be interested in adopting this type of governance. Currently, 24 states allow consolidated government, and it seems to sort of anecdotally work best in smaller, in less populated areas. There are four of these types of governing bodies in the largest state of the union, and there are several of them in the state that is immediately north of the first national park. In the case of our community, we have 20,000 people in our entire county, and yet we have two full sets of elected officials. We've got a town administrator, county administrator, two full sets of law enforcement, two planning departments. It's a whole lot of government for 20,000 people. And although we do have joint boards, there are still separate responsibilities for those governments, and it creates a lot of bureaucracy. One of the questions that came up in the committee was, is this taking away rights of some of the people who live in the county? In other words, would it be enforcing ordinances onto county dwellers? And effectively, I think that's answered because it would be a popular vote of the people for that county. As the good chairman of the Corporations Committee pointed out during the hearings, it's a long road that we would be looking at to start this process. But this gives us a framework to start, and from there the legislature would be able to enact statutes to allow us to do this, and then the community, if there were any communities interested, would be able to then vote on whether or not they wanted to pursue this type of governance. And again, it's a many-year process, but this would be the first step. So I'll stand for any questions.
Is there any further discussion? Mr. Speaker Pro Tem.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I just rise in support of this bill. And just to remind people, really only one county, Teton County, is the only county that has only one municipality. So that's really the one area that this would really be affecting, because we could actually do it without causing too much issues, mostly because we already do a lot of this stuff together. We have a joint Parks and Rec Department. We have a joint our bus service is joint. Quite a few of our departments are joint. But there are certain things that we cannot combine, which is causing issues, in particularly our planning issues between the town and the county. We actually try to write our comp plan and our land development regulations in concert, but it would actually work better if we were one government to do that. Other communities could do it and exempt out certain municipalities that did not want to join in. So I'm not saying others couldn't do it, but this would greatly help our community, and particularly to to do this. And all this is doing is putting on the ballot to see if the voters would allow for the legislature at a later date to create a framework for it. So this is just the very beginning of a long process.
Chairman Brown.
Mr. Chairman, I support this. There's a couple of areas I'm concerned about that could be fixed with amendment that I think we ought to think about. One is perhaps in addition to this, something to the effect that in no way will it affect any existing debt. The other one is, and I think that we had some discussion about it last time, and it's still a problem. I think there was a big issue over whether the requirement for a vote of the electors of the affected county and municipalities meant the voters of each entity or if it was a combined vote. And I guess if the amendment passed, it would be up to the legislature to sort that out. But as I recall, that was a big problem last time. I worked for the Governor's Crime Commission when I was in law school. I went around the state and talked to every sheriff, every clerk of the district court, looked at every jail, and talked to every judge. And I can tell you this has been a problem in Wyoming for a long time because I'm older than dirt. And I saw examples then that have not gotten any better of law enforcement agencies competing with each other and actually hiding evidence from each other and duplication of services that is just a horrible expense. So I support this. I would encourage the sponsor to think about any amendments you might want in response to my comments, but I really wish that we could get this in a posture where they could try, because I think it has there's always going to be turf battles. People in town say, well, if you do this, too many resources will go to the country. And people in the country say, well, if you do this, all the resources will go to town. We'll never see a law enforcement person again. But in the end, there's accountability to the voters throughout the entire county, and we ought to be able to figure out a way to make it work. So I hope we can go forward with this. I think it's really a good idea.
Mr. Speaker.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Just one question for the good representative from House District 16. In the past, there have been discussions on the combination of counties into one county, and I look at this and it calls for the possibility to consolidate, or it calls for the unification of counties and municipalities. And I can read that two ways. The language could be restrictive in that you're combining a county with a municipality, which is what you're talking about. Could this also be used to unify two separate counties as well? Because we've had discussions on that in the past.
Representative Stepson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Rising on and against the joint resolution. One of the things that we really should do when we look at changing our Constitution is engage in a thorough analysis of all the implications of those changes. And that's really what led me to vote against it in committee, and I think why this barely made it out of committee. And it's because of one line, on line 18. And it's sort of a simple line that has the potential for seismic shifts in how we govern in this state. And that says that these consolidated agencies, if you take a city and county and you consolidate them, that combined entity, the county, will then be treated as a municipality for all other purposes. The reason that that's significant is because the way we are structured in Wyoming now, counties are governmental entities of limited authority. We prescribe their authority, and we delineate those areas in which they have authority. And you know that there's some things that counties just can't do. They can't eliminate certain kinds of land use within the county. There's a host of things that counties cannot do. In Title 15, we have a list of municipal powers that goes on for about four pages. And among those is the ability to really home rule, to pass ordinances and to pass laws under which the citizens of a given city can operate. And so this, what this really would do, and you need to really understand this before you cast the vote, is to take a government of limited authority and transform it into a government of unlimited authority. It is to take counties that have prescribed areas of authority and give them ability to pass ordinances, whether it be for certain land uses or whatever, throughout the county. And to me, that's a concern because we do it constitutionally. Once we pass this amendment, you can't separate that municipal authority from what these consolidated governments have. You can't do it another way because we have in the Constitution said, no, for purposes of what these powers are, we're going to meld that government entity into the authority that the cities already have. That's a huge step. I think it's a step that robs us of flexibility down the road if entities do choose to consolidate. And I think it far overshadows the limited benefits that you might receive that you can't receive already from forming joint powers boards and unifying different services. So I'd ask you to vote against the bill. Representative Petroff.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. To address the concerns of the good representative from District 56, it would require a vote of the people, and so it would be their voluntary action to enter into this, just like if they were forming a municipality. And the chairman from District 14, I would definitely be in favor of adding language about making sure that no debt was absolved and that the voters of each entity would be approving it so that it wouldn't be swallowing up any constituents who might not want to be part of this type of governance. And with regard to what the speaker mentioned, I'm definitely amenable to any changes that would help define that it would be between a municipality and a county, not between multiple counties.
Chairman Brown.
Mr. Chairman, I fully appreciate the concerns voiced by the representative from District 56, but we ought to get on with it. And I wish you'd vote for this and give them a chance to try to address some of those things. It is true right now that a county is a political subdivision of the state and that cities enjoy some measure of home rule, and you can decide how much of that you have or how much you don't have. But we have been creeping that way anyway, as we give counties more and more authority to, and I've been an advocate of even more of that because it's closer to the people than we are. But as we give counties more and more authority, then they begin to have some limited powers to make ordinances and to make rulings with respect to that govern the citizens of those jurisdictions. And one of the problems we have with counties right now that's solved if you meld them into the statutes on cities is that in counties there's no initiative and referendum procedure. And if they're going to be making ordinances and doing things, then we ought to have it. And if you look in the statutes, for instance, in the fireworks thing, we gave the counties the authority to ban fireworks, and in that statute we built into it an initiative and referendum procedure with respect to that one ordinance. Well, it just makes the point that we're creeping that way, and it's going to be a long, difficult road. I wouldn't want to minimize what we're talking about, but it's high time that we got on with it, because if we had an explosion of growth next year and we went from 500,000 people to 2 million people, we would have to start looking to our counties to provide more of the governing structure of our state. I don't think there'd be any way out of it. Why don't we, on a measured basis, while we have time, get it sorted out and proceed with it? So I just wish you'd at least pass this thing and give them a chance, see if they can amend it, and see if we can get this thing in a form that might work.
Representative Laux.
Mr. Speaker, I too believe that any time we look at a constitutional amendment, it's very serious stuff. But I have a question for the bringer of the bill, because I am interested in some parts. Will this allow consolidation of departments? Like I've always, the county that I live in, 182 miles north of here, is we have duplication in many areas. I mean, like for example, why do we have two police departments? You know, sheriff's department, just there's repetition, everything. Does this cover that type of thing, too? Is it? That's my question.
Representative Petroff.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you for the question, Representative from District 59. This would allow for consolidated departments, and actually currently you can have consolidated departments with joint powers agreements or with contracted services, but this just eliminates that layer of bureaucracy to have those consolidated departments. And a lot of those questions about exactly how it would work would be answered in statute, but this would just give us the framework to start developing those statutes.
Is there any further discussion on the bill? Do I hear a call for the question? Question having been called, all those in favor of Chairman Illaway's motion that when the Committee of the Whole rises to report it, do so with the recommendation that House Joint Resolution 5 do pass, please say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, no.
No.
House Joint Resolution 5 has passed the Committee of the Whole. The next bill for our consideration is House Bill 50. The reading clerk will read the bill.
House Bill 50, introduced by the Labor Committee, an act relating to the administration of government regarding health insurance exchanges. This bill was referred to Committee Number 10, Labor, Health, and Social Services, which recommended it do pass with amendments. Ayes, Kraft, Green, Harvey, Miller, Peasley, no, Barbudo, Gay, Gingrey, Hunt. The bill was further referred to Committee Number 2, Appropriations, which recommended it do pass with amendments. Ayes, Berger, Escobel, Harshman, Pedersen, Stewart, no, Edmonds, Wallace. Signed, Representative Berger, Chairman.
You've heard the reading of the bill. What's your pleasure? Vice Chairman Miller.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I move that when Committee of the Whole rises to report, it do so with the recommendation that Bill Number 50 do pass, and I further move the adoption of the Standing Committee Amendment Number 1. What this amendment does is just clear up some language in there. On page 1, line 13, we simply remove the word reconnaissance. It was just an extra word that wasn't needed. Some of the other areas, there were references to some states across the U.S. One state in the far east of the U.S. was referenced on lines 12 through 14. Another state was referenced in the Standing Committee Amendment on lines 16 through 19. We're just taking those out and cleaning up the language to make the bill a little smoother, and I ask for your favorable vote on the Standing Committee Amendment Number 1.
You've heard the motion on Standing Committee Amendment Number 1. Are you ready for the question? All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, no. Standing Committee Amendment Number 1 is passed. Chairman Berger.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I move Standing Committee Amendment Number 2 to House Bill 50 and ask for your favorable consideration. This bill came before us in House Appropriations, and what we did, which is unusual in most circumstances, is we added extensions to the program rather than a haircut. When this bill was being worked in the committee, they did not have enough information on what this new program would cost, and the fiscal note that we received in appropriations was approximately $145,000. So we deleted the original $5,000 and inserted the $145,000. So I'd ask for your favorable vote.
You've heard the motion on standing. Oh, you're ready for the question. All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, no.
No.
The amendment passes. Vice Chair Miller.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. The bill will be managed by the Chairman Harvey, please.
Chairman Harvey.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. On your desks, you have two handouts. And one says that state from to the south west of us, health exchange. And the other one says a state to the east of us, health insurance exchange. And this is just going to be two of the examples of what we're doing. But let me preface this by saying a lot of states, two states, enacted health insurance exchanges before the federal health care bill passed. And it was a way to regulate insurance. It was a way to help people buy insurance by being able to group together, by being able to buy individual policies. One of the states, and you do not have a handout from them, but it was the first one, it was actually a state-based system. And this state-based system was moving toward a single payer, and that was the state. And it was being supported by additional taxes from their state. The first one that I mentioned to the south of us did it as a free market-based system. And so I just wanted to let you know that there are some examples out there of health insurance exchanges that were before the Affordable Care Act was enacted. But now we have the Affordable Care Act, and part of that is that the state is required to do something about a health insurance exchange. And we have three choices. We can develop our own. We can partner with others. And or we can default, we can do nothing, and the federal government will run a health insurance exchange and fold us into it. So the question is, what do we want to do? Before we knew that there was a grant available to study health insurance exchanges, the Labor Committee and during the interim knew that this was going to be one of those things that had a very short timeline. We are supposed to have our insurance exchange designed and ready to go, but not enacted, designed and ready to go January 1, 2013, and functioning January 1, 2014. So it's a very, very short timeline. And to give you an example of that, the state to the south and west of us, it did their enacting legislation 3 years ago, and they are still not running. It takes that long to study it, to understand it, to work with your insurance companies. There's just a lot involved in making sure that the product that you have in the end serves the citizens of the state. So before you, you see a bill that was developed late in the process. We started a bill at the beginning of the process, and it was fight, fight, fight. We don't want it, we don't want it, we don't want it. So we're going to study all the reasons why we don't want it. But toward the end of the process, as you know, when we let out of session last year, we authorized the governor to apply for and accept grants from the federal government that he felt would be a benefit. And so when this grant came up for $800,000 to study health insurance exchanges, he did apply for it and set up his own task force. When we met in December, the task force had already met. And so why would you say we would need this bill then? There is a task force in place. It has good people that are serving on it, looking at states, looking at private individuals that, private companies that are providing exchanges. And so there were still some questions that we wanted to know. If you'll look at page one, starting on line 13, the governor shall conduct a study to of whether to create an insurance exchange, participate in a regional exchange. Page two. We're going to start to see some things that the federal government, I don't think, would be very happy with participating in this part of the study. And on lines 19 through 21, this study shall recommend whether the state should decide to proceed or not proceed with the development of an exchange. And then if we decide to proceed, up on the top of page 3, provide a work plan for the development of the exchange and identify any legislation needed to implement the exchange during the 2012 legislative budget session or subsequent legislative sessions. And if you'll please bear with me, my working bill that's all marked up got left in some committee room yesterday, so I'm going to have to find the other two places that there are things on page 3, lines 12 through 17. Evaluate whether the exchange will help the operation of the private marketplace in a health insurance by helping people comparison shop for health insurance and reducing the market cost for health insurance. That's not one of the things that the federal government asked us to study. And then on the bottom, 19 through 21, it said consider the experience of and then name two states. That was part of the original standing committee amendment, was to remove those states and just say others, because we found that there are other states that are doing that. And then on the top of page 4 also was amended to remove the name of the state. Evaluate whether the exchange would offer the full scope of services that others provide or a more limited scope of services. Recommend whether Wyoming should proceed with the development of an exchange if the Health Care Act is repealed. And that's one of the things that we need to pay for. That was why we had an increase in the appropriation, is that there are things that we need to pay for. If we think that we want to, or that if health care reform is repealed, do we still want a health insurance exchange? Now, this is probably the most controversial part, lines 10 through 19. Evaluate whether there's a reasonable opportunity for successful litigation to prevent the federal government from proceeding with the health insurance exchange serving Wyoming if Wyoming decides not to create a Wyoming health insurance exchange or create an exchange with a limited scope not meeting all of the requirements of health care reform acts. The study shall also evaluate whether the operation of a federal exchange would do sufficient harm to the people of Wyoming, meaning cost too much. So the litigation, I'm sure the federal government doesn't want to pay for us to study that. And then see if we can facilitate the sale of insurance across state lines. If you remember, our fine speaker last year brought a bill to us, which we passed, to enable us to buy and sell insurance across state lines. And so this is just, again, studying, is this the right thing for us to do? On the top of page 5, 1 through 5, there is another bill that you're going to be seeing coming out of the Senate that also was a Labor Committee bill. And it is a study of what is it going to cost Wyoming when health care is enacted. And so lines 1 through 5 say, consider whether a decision by Wyoming to opt out of the Medicaid program or other provisions of the national health insurance reform would affect the ability of other states to join with Wyoming in the sale of insurance across state lines. So if we decide to not participate in Medicaid, that also puts us not participating in the SCHIP program. We'd have to replace that with something. The question is, would then the federal government bar us from playing nicely with other states? We don't want that to happen. So that's one of the things that we need to consider. And then line 7 through 9 is the preliminary report. And then following that, you can see appropriation. We put $5,000 as a placeholder because we really didn't know how extensive this study would be. We did know that we would need to hire some experts. We didn't know if some of that could be covered. And then it's got all of the standard language down on line 19, notwithstanding any other provision. Any of this appropriation not used could be reverted. And then the final page is the fiscal note. And I've got an old fiscal note on this, which says $5,000. But upon further study, the governor's office came back and said to hire the consultants that we would need and to have the additional meetings that we would need, the appropriation would need to be bigger than that. Now, if I could get you to turn to your handouts, this is what an insurance exchange looks like. The one from the state to the south of us, if you look across the top of the page, it lists three companies. And then follow the matrix down the left side of the page, and it talks about the plan name. You can see where it says the estimated monthly premium. And what it does is from all three of these companies, it compares the advantages, the benefits, the costs, everything that is in that plan. So you can look at, okay, what is it that I want? Do I want generic brand formulary drugs, or do I want name brand? Is that important to me or not? And so I'm going to look down here at drugs and decide which company I want based on that. I'm going to look at how much deductible I want. And all of those things are just going to be so transparent, because you can pick out some of the things that you are interested in, and right across the top is the premium. So you would be able to know what you would be able to pay. Now, if you go to the second handout, the one from the state far east of us, or mid-east of us, this is their portal to go to. And so you can go online and look at this and enroll for insurance right here online. You can manage your own account. You can request an exemption based on religious or other reasons. Or you can just go and learn more. If you turn to the second page, you fill in your name, a little bit of information, your female, birth date, social security number, zip code, and then pretty soon this portal gathers data from other sophisticated computer IT. For instance, this particular state is connected to the IRS. And so if you look, there's a password. Well, I think it's several pages back. But it will say, is this your income? It asks who in the household is pregnant, meaning that's going to be, I guess it's on, these pages aren't numbered, but it's the second piece of paper on the back side. It says your total monthly income is $1,800. Is this correct? Yes or no? So it does pull data from other sources. This is just one way that states can provide the information, or this is one way of enrolling. It doesn't mean it would be our way, but it's some of the things that we need to look at. How invasive do we want to be? How much privacy do we want to preserve? What is it that we want? That's why we need to study this. There are some other factors involved. Wyoming is a small state with an aging population. We're not considered the best risk pool, meaning we're not the healthiest group of folks in the Western United States. The task force has already contacted several other states and asked, can we play with you? One state in particular said, well, you'd be our last choice. So we don't know if there are other states that will. And we haven't even begun in the negotiation part of this. But the point is, if we're going to do this, if we're going to be required to do this, we better know what we're doing. And that's the reason for the task force. And we have some other questions to say, you know, Wyoming's pretty darn independent, and we intend to stay that way. So we want to have the answers to these other questions. And that is the point of the second appropriation, or the appropriation that was actually given hair extensions instead of a haircut from appropriations, is so that we could have an adequate study and know what's right for Wyoming. So with that, I would stand for any questions.
Mr. Speaker Pro Tem.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I move Committee of the Whole Amendment Number 1. What this amendment does, if you flip to into the bill on page 2, what it says is, in subsection C, line 10, the governor shall designate a study oversight task force to conduct the study. My concern was this, that the governor already set up the task force. So the first question always that comes to your mind is, then why do we need this bill if he's already doing this? The reason was that it's because he took federal funds in order to set up that task force. There are narrow parameters that he's allowed to use that money for. The legislature, through this bill, is asking for some bigger questions to be asked, questions that are very unique to us particularly. So that's why you need the bill. But on top of that is if we're going to do it, then perhaps we should be the ones creating the committee. There's usually sort of three or four different levels of committees. There's task force committees, and a task force primarily is usually used for advising the governor, to help the governor create policy. Then above that is steering committees. Steering committees are usually made up of all three branches of government. We had the drug court steering committee a few years ago that was made up of judiciary, executive, and legislative. And that sort of helps to guide new legislation. And then above that, of course, you have select committees, which is just legislators on the committee. This appears it appears that they want to have not only executive and legislative, but they also want to have people from industry on the committee. So what this does is create the same exact committee, but it calls it a steering committee, which I thought was a more appropriate use of the word than task force, because it's not only, if it's task force, then I think it would just be simply advising the governor, and then we probably don't need the bill. But if it's a steering committee, then they're advising both the governor and the legislative branch on what they think should happen. The other, and so what I did, I went and got the list from the governor's office of who's on the committee already, and that's who I put on this amendment. So all the same people will get to stay on the committee. We're just designating who they all are. The governor already appointed, two senators, two representatives, two people from the business community, two domestic insurance company people, one medical provider. So all the same people get to stay on the committee. The only distinction is that in this amendment, I have the co-chairs being one senator and one representative. How the governor has it set up now is the legislators sit beneath a executive. Actually, she's the interim director of Division of Mental Health and Substance Abuse, runs this task force. And I didn't think the legislator should sit beneath that person. I think the legislator should actually be the co-chairs of the committee. So it would switch that to having the one representative and one senator being the co-chairs. And then number two, it provides that those legislative members would be compensated for their time. This is going to take a lot of time and energy of those four legislators that get appointed, and I thought they should be compensated per diem for being on that committee. So really, as the amendment almost has very little to do with the bill, but it has more to do with separation of branches, that if we're going to be setting up a committee of some sort, then we should set it up. I mean, if the governor wants to set up a committee, that's fine. But then we don't really need to be part of it either way. Anyway, it was just an idea.
Any further discussion on Committee of the Whole Amendment Number 1? Chairman Harvey?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I would consider this a friendly amendment. I think it is a policy decision. I think there are a lot of things that we have to look at beyond the grant that the governor did apply for, beyond the task force that was set up. And I think that in order to have our questions answered, I think it's appropriate that this switch gears and come from our branch of government. Now, having said that, I also have to disclose that I am a member of the task force. And there is another representative that sits on this floor that is also a member of this task force. There are two senators.
I wouldn't expect the membership to change. And so I just, in full disclosure, I'm not doing this because I think that it would be a change in my income, but I think that it would be a shift in the policy itself. And that is, are our questions going to be answered, and who will ensure that to happen? So I think this is a friendly amendment.
All those in favor of Committee of the Whole Amendment Number 1, please say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, no.
No.
The amendment passes. We're back on the bill. Is there any further discussion?
Aye.
Question being called. All those in favor of Vice Chairman Miller's motion that when the Committee of the Whole rises to report it, do so with the recommendation that House Bill 50 do pass, please say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, no.
No.
House Bill 50 has passed the Committee of the Whole. The next bill for our consideration is House Bill 118. The reading clerk will read the bill.
House Bill 118, introduced by Representative Brechtel, an act relating to public health and safety, abortion available information for decision. This bill was sent to Committee Number 10, Labor, Health, and Social Services, which recommended that it do pass with following amendments. Ayes, Gay, Gingrey, Green, Harvey, Hunt, Miller, Peasley, no, Barbuto, Kraft, sign Representative Harvey, Chairman.
You've heard the reading of the bill. What's your pleasure? Chairman Harvey.
Whoa. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I move that when the Committee of the Whole rises to report, it do so with the recommendation that House Bill 118 do pass. And I would turn the explanation of the bill over to the sponsor.
Madam Chairman, would you like to move the standing committee amendment right now, too?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I move standing committee amendment number 1 and turn the explanation of that as well over to the sponsor of the bill.
Representative Brechtel.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I bring you House Bill 118. First of all, it's just been a little over a week ago that we celebrated an important holiday, and the person that we honored on that holiday, his niece is the leader of a campaign who seeks to expose and heal the secrecy and silence surrounding the emotional and physical pain of abortion. Part of their pain stems largely from the misinformation about abortion, but too often to realize too late that the dignity of their unborn. Even worse is a haunting question of the torture and pain that can be inflicted, especially during late-term abortions. Women have a right to know the truth about their preborn babies before deciding to have an abortion or not. And members of the 61st, that's all this bill attempts to do, is make it known that she has a right to a little bit of information, unlike what some of the information that's been passed out. She is not required to accept it, to have an ultrasound or otherwise. If she wanted an ultrasound, many of our communities will provide free ultrasound. And even at that, abortion providers nowadays use the latest technology available to them. The tools, part of their tools includes modern-day ultrasound. And so there, once again, is another misgiving. At 20 weeks, the unborn child has hair, working vocal cords, sucks her thumb, grasps with her hands, and kicks. She'll measure about 12 inches. Despite the baby's advanced development at 20 weeks, dilation and evacuation is still one of the abortion methods. Sharp-edged instruments are used to grasp, twist, and tear the body into pieces. This continues until her entire body is removed from the womb. U.S. Supreme Court Justice Kennedy described the procedure, saying, "The fetus in many cases dies just as a human adult or a child would. It bleeds to death as it is torn limb from limb," unquote. Anesthesia is a consideration if the baby needs surgery before birth. But hundreds of studies show overwhelmingly that especially by 20 weeks, she will experience pain during an intrusive procedure. If abortion is the choice, anesthesia is not generally a consideration for the quote-unquote fetus. Something seems unethical. The U.S. Supreme Court upheld state statutes requiring informed consent, much more stringent than what we're asking for here. This bill does not require that the mother purchase anything. She is not required to accept the information. It's hard to understand why anyone would oppose better educating women, especially unless it's the abortion industry who have made millions in deceiving women about abortion. If this act were to prevent the injury of even one mother, it will have done its job. The fact is, we don't know how many abortions are actually performed in Wyoming. The industry does not see our law for reporting as being important. Yesterday, you received a handout in your box that would have looked something like this. It contains information on fetal pain, maps showing similar laws have been enacted. In fact, there's about 32 states so far have enacted, at least 32 states have enacted some form of legislation of this sort. At least six states so far have included fetal pain medication as part of their statute. Let me walk you through the bill. Beginning on page one, at the bottom, except in the case of a medical emergency, 24-hour notice is given that that the mother has a right to see an ultrasound if she wants. Modern-day ultrasound has all of the clarity needed to meet the conditions under line 5, going down to line 16. Beginning on line 17, we talk about if the baby is at 20 weeks gestation, she should be offered information about fetal pain. Going over on page 3 and down to beginning on line 19, we talk about the exceptions to this. In the case of medical emergency, this would not apply. Or in the case of removing a dead unborn child, an ectopic pregnancy. And then there's
definition of medical emergency, qualified person. And that is the bill. But under this piece of legislation, all it is an attempt to stand for rights of women, whom I have to admit I have worked very close with, pregnancy center close to home, and I have seen the damage done by abortion. I cannot deny. For that, I'll stand for questions.
We're still on standing committee amendment number one. Did you want to explain that, Representative Brechtel? Oh,
thank you, Mr. Chairman. I will go ahead and the amendment moved. This amendment, all it does is provides for documentation. And it actually is a protection for the doctor to be able to document something and drop in her file just so that he can prove in case he's challenged whether or not he's done his duty. And that's all the amendment really is. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Is there any further discussion on Standing Committee Amendment Number 1? Ready for the question? All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, no. The amendment passes. We're back on the bill. Representative Wallace.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I've made 6 different plans about how I would speak to this issue, and I've probably discarded all of them and started over. I can't begin to tell you how many times. I think it's a shame that those of you on this floor who have a particular religious viewpoint or a deep feeling one way or the other on this particular issue have only this bill to deal with, because this bill is really not talking about what the real issues are. Let me begin. I had passed out a little bit ago a document called We Affirm, Religious Organizations Support Reproductive Choice. And I think that as you read through these numerous religious organizations who compassionately affirm a woman's moral right to make reproductive decisions according to her own conscience and religious principles, you know, I think we all regard abortion as having a tragic dimension that should call for the concern and compassion of us all. I think many of us recognize tragic conflicts of life with life that may justify abortion. And in such cases, we support the legal option of abortion under proper medical procedures. I think many of us would object and cannot affirm abortion as an acceptable means of birth control. I think many of us would unconditionally reject it as a means of gender selection. But what this bill does is say that as a woman, that I'm not smart enough to know the decision that I'm making, that somehow the state is required in this particular decision where they are required in no other medical decision. If it was truly the only thing that this bill did was to require the offering of an ultrasound, fine. I really don't have any problem with that. I think that in most cases, probably all cases, a woman who has made the decision to terminate a pregnancy has already made that decision before she ever picks up the phone to arrange for an appointment. The reasons that she has come to that conclusion, we have no way of knowing. We have no way of knowing the complexities. Or the circumstances under what that, why and when that decision might be made. Here's why this particular piece of legislation is, in my mind, really irrelevant in Wyoming. State law does require that these procedures be reported. There is a requirement for those things to be filed with the State Board of Vital Statistics. We have exactly one provider in this state who has apparently provided maybe 7 procedures this year. 7. Nobody knows how many women have gone to other states. I suspect some have. Wyoming law already says that these procedures cannot happen after viability. In your box, you also received a handout that looks like this. And on that handout, about midway down, is a chart that shows where viability is physically and scientifically possible. Wyoming law already says that procedures at the 20th week, they're not legal. They never happen, they never have, and they never will. There is no provider in Wyoming who has ever provided one of these procedures in our history since it became legal to do so beyond the 13th week. So all of these conditions in the bill that are predicated on the case where an unborn child is 20 weeks of gestation or more, it will never happen. It's already illegal by our Wyoming state law. So we're never even going to get to that point. Also on that front sheet and on the next page are some indications about scientific evidence of when fetal pain can be felt. Pretty much agreement that it's only in the third trimester. Again, these procedures will never happen in Wyoming. They are already illegal. And no provider comes anywhere within weeks of providing a procedure where that would be the case. It just isn't going to happen. The second page of that handout has some characteristics about women who seek these procedures. These are national characteristics. But the thing that I want to point to you is that most women, this is the fourth bullet point down, most women, 61% of them, already have at least one child. And 34% of them have two or more children when they seek this procedure. I think that's informative. I'm going to make a couple other points, and then I'm going to tell you a story. The next page has a whole list of all of the available birth control that we have today. And let me tell you, this is a much better list than when I was a young woman. We only had a few options then. But even today, with these much better options, if you look down through that list, you will see that with the birth control pill, there's still a percent of a chance that you will become pregnant. And I can tell you that I have children living today that are living proof of that fact. Now we have things like Norplant and the patch, which make it much easier for women who are not in a position to have children to be able to decide and to control that. But it's not perfect. It's still not perfect, and human beings aren't perfect, and we never have been, and we never will be. These are horrible issues that humankind has had to deal with since the beginning of time. One objection that I have to this bill is the requirement for a 24-hour waiting period. Why? If the intention is to offer women some information, why can't that be provided over the phone? Why can't that be provided the day that she travels across the state? It seems to me that the only reason to put that in place is to make it more difficult. In my opinion, in kind of an ugly, coercive way to try and convince a woman who has already made a decision, a very difficult, a very heartrending, a very soul-searching decision, that the only purpose is to throw up some roadblocks and make that time, that difficult time, more difficult. So let me tell you about a moral decision that I once faced. I had and I struggle and I hesitate because these are deeply personal things. But the reason I want to tell them to you all is because I want you to know that this is just one of many, many stories. And there are so many different circumstances that people in this country have to deal with. We can't make broad blanket statements. We can't decide what's in a human being's heart. My first child was born while I was taking birth control pills, taking them religiously, doing everything I could to be a responsible person. Nonetheless, I found out that a child was on the way. It wasn't the best of situations. I didn't have a partner to stand beside me and to go through that. But I did have a wonderful family. And so I went back to my family and I said, here's the position that I'm in. And bless their hearts, they stood beside me. And it was the best decision that I ever made in my life. A few years later, I was always a person who wanted a warm and loving relationship, a family. I'd watch my grandparents. My parents had beautiful marriages that lasted a lifetime, and I wanted that. I met a charming man, but you know, we don't always make the best decisions the first go around, and I wasn't fortunate enough to find the perfect person that go around, and we had a couple of children. But I need to back up just a little bit, because about a year after my first son was born, I was diagnosed with precancerous cervical cancer, that I had precancerous cells. And so I had to go into the hospital and have a conal biopsy, which is basically taking a conal shape out of the bottom of my cervix. And they were able to get rid of all of the precancerous cells through that procedure. And I never, in all the years since, I've never had another problem. So thank God for that. But what they told me at the end of that, they said, we don't think you may have trouble getting pregnant. That wasn't quite the case. And they said, if you do become pregnant, you may not be able to carry a child to term because your cervix has been weakened so much. So when I married, very quickly, child number two came along. And she was born very premature. She was very healthy. We were able to get along fine. Child number three came along. Again, very high-risk pregnancy, lots of complications, born very prematurely, spent a lot of time on my back, spent a lot of time really, really, really worried and really, really, really concerned. About a year after that, our marriage was not doing well. Turns out my former spouse could be diagnosed as having a fairly serious personality disorder. And those mental problems were becoming more and more prevalent. Nonetheless, we were doing our darndest, and the third pregnancy happened. At this point, we were seriously considering splitting up. But we decided, you know, this child is on its way. We need to give it a chance. And so we did everything we could to reconcile our differences and come together and try to make that happen. And I'm so thankful every day that even though in that tense and not very good marital situation, I made a personal commitment that I would do everything I possibly could. I would be as healthy as I could be. I would follow every direction. I would do everything that I could to make sure that that child was healthy. In spite of those things, and thank God that I did those things, or I probably would have been racked with guilt to this day, 2 weeks before that child, a baby girl, was going to be born, she died in my womb. And I faced the very real, very horrible, very tragic situation of giving birth to a dead child, fully formed dead child. My former spouse's mental problems were getting worse. It was spiraling into physical abuse. My parents, bless their hearts, loaned me their ranch payment, and I went to town and became a 30-year-old freshman with three kids and went to school. But I come from a place and a culture where a marriage is a marriage, and by golly, you do everything you can to make it work. So after I had already enrolled in school, and long about that time, my former spouse came and wanted to restart again, and I agreed. About 2 weeks later, there was a major explosion that included some physical stuff that was damaging to me. And we went our separate ways. And about 2 weeks after that, I discovered I was pregnant. By that time, he was already living with another woman with kids. I had 3 little babies to take care of. I had been through numerous high-risk pregnancies with very serious complications. I had already experienced the tragic death of one of those. For me, in my religious and moral upbringing, there really was only 2 choices. Ever. And those 2 choices were raise these children the best way I know how, put everything I have into making sure that they are good and healthy and true human beings. And if that was not possible, to terminate the pregnancy. Some will say that adoption is something that people should do, and God bless them. For those of you who are working to help women who want to go that route, bless you. But in my moral universe, that just wasn't an option. And if I had gone that route, my parents were living in a 5th-wheel trailer house and traveling. They were in no position to take us in. We had the ranch. We lost the big ranch. We only had the ranch that's the core of the ranch where we're at now. I was already in a messy, horrible custody battle. If I would have gone through with that, I would have lost my 3 children to a man that I knew had mental problems and was physically abusive. So when I weighed all those things, and you might have made a different decision than I did, but those were the things that were confronting me. And the thing I want to make sure you understand is that's just one story. There's a zillion variations out there. And we as a state should not be interfering with those very personal, very private, very that our ability as free moral agents cannot justify these broad strokes. So should this go forward, I would hope to amend it by taking out all of those things that are not true and are misleading, which there are many in this bill. I know that some of you, maybe many of you, feel like you have to vote one way or another on this bill to make some broad statement. But I just ask you, as a human being, as a friend, and as a colleague, not to pass mass judgment on your fellow human beings.
Representative Edmonds.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Ladies and gentlemen, I actually wasn't going to speak on this bill. But this morning, and you all got them in your box as well, we got 2 pieces of information. And I read them, and I was rather shocked. So I hobbled off the floor, and I called my sister, who is today working in a level 1, I think I can say this, neonatal ICU. I think I can say that. I just can't say where. In the state with the sunflower. Because I've spent many a Christmas dinner and Thanksgiving dinner and every other time I've been there to visit her, to talking about her job. And
I was really surprised at what I read. So I want to give you some information, some factual information about fetal pain and about what we do and don't know about it and about the studies that are out there and the studies that have not taken place. Because I think that we have to make informed decisions on this floor. And I think we have to know things and we have to be able to look something squarely in the eye and know what we're dealing with squarely in the eye. So on the first page of the handout with the staple, a couple pages, fourth paragraph, we have the sentence, fetuses are not capable of feeling pain at the beginning of the fetal stage and may not be able to feel pain until the third trimester. And there's a citing of something. Unfortunately, it doesn't tell me what. When you go on, I can't get it, so I don't know what they're citing. I suspect I know what it is, and I'll tell you about that. The first part of the sentence, fetuses are not capable of feeling pain at the beginning of the fetal stage, completely untrue statement. Do you know why? There is no study. There is no study. We have never studied at the beginning of the human development. There is nothing that can verify that statement. The second half, which I think is what the reference is about, and may not be able to feel pain until the third trimester, if you go to the other one that we got, from a different organization, and it's under fetal pain assumptions, are not based on medical evidence. It says ECG suggests fetal pain cannot be perceived prior to 29 weeks gestational age, and it cites a study by S. Lee, a highly controversial, scientifically flawed study authored by an extreme activist. This is not a held view on of every medical practitioner out there. Trust me, they don't agree with this. You know why? Because my sister is standing there working today in a level one NICU administering pain medicine to 20 to 23 week babies. Why? Because they know they feel pain. Since 2005, if you walked into a NICU before 2005, it would have been bright, lights on, lots of beats, loud things. They would have intubated. They would have started IVs. Zero pain control. That has all changed. It's quiet. The machines are not loud. They're silent. They're trying to emulate the womb because they know these babies heal better when they don't feel pain, when everything is kept the way it is naturally, and they administer pain control. Because these babies feel pain. My sister said, Amy, I've watched the heart rates go up before. I saw what I was doing, and I knew that child felt pain. Science is about observation, and they observed it, and they knew. Now, why have these studies not happened? Because this bill is about exactly what it's about, but it gets politicized. There aren't medical studies because politics interferes, because we are afraid to face this stuff. Well, we got to face it, folks, squarely. So face it. Science will take us to the place we need to go about humans and about how we develop. But we have to have the courage to face it. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Representative Madden.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm concerned about the, you know, statement that was made earlier about the latter 20 weeks gestation or more. And if we've already got a law that says that those kind of procedures can't be done within that range of time, to me, I'm not a lawyer, obviously, but to me, you can't put something in the law identifying the proper procedures to do a procedure that we've already said is illegal. You know, and I'm assuming that the person that raised that issue, you know, is right about it. But if they are right, we can't be passing that and then saying it's illegal to do it because we're outlining the right procedures if you break the law. And, you know, that's just one of the problems I have with this. I think that there's, you know, some overreaching comments up there in line 10 and 11 of page 2 that are not appropriate. It's more making a statement than it is clarifying the law. And I just think that when you got all that, we can't let a bill like that go forward if, in fact, these procedures from line that described in 17 and below on that page are actually, in fact, illegal elsewhere in our statutes. Thank you.
Representative Kraft.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chair.
this is obviously a highly emotional and a highly charged topic. I don't want to belabor points that have already been made, and I would like to take the emotionality out of it for just a little bit, if we could. The previous speaker made a point that I would really like to underscore. This bill, and much of the information we have been receiving about this bill, talks about 20 to 23 weeks. Even the good speaker discussing fetal pain talked about it at 20 to 23 weeks. That's illegal in the state of Wyoming. We don't do that. In our committee, we heard a number of physicians tell us there is one county in this state that will perform an abortion at all. They will not do them after 12 weeks. They really prefer 8 to 9 weeks. So what you're hearing, the information you're hearing, and it's as horrifying to me as I'm sure it is to you, is about something that doesn't happen here. And indeed, if it did happen here, it would be illegal. So we already have our statute. We already have a Wyoming statute that addresses that. And just one other point that I would like to make. We talk about giving people information. The good sponsor says, this is what I want. I want people to have information. Well, me too. I truly believe you can't make an informed decision unless you've got the information, got all your facts, got everything you need to know about that subject. But I would present to you that any physician in this state will provide informed consent. I got informed consent when I had a wart taken off my finger. We get informed consent from the medical profession. I would suggest that the information we're talking about now might be something that we might script. And I'm not sure why we, as a state government, want to interfere in the doctor-patient relationship. The other thing that disturbs me, and I just want to take a minute and talk about this, is the mandatory 24-hour waiting period. Now, I spent many, many years and most of my working career as a school counselor, and I still work in private practice. And over those years, you can imagine how many young women I worked with and consulted with who were facing an unintended pregnancy. And I will tell you that they spent way more than 24 hours agonizing, soul searching. I will tell you I never had one that arrived at a decision without consulting parents, teachers, clergy, medical professionals. They'd spent their 24 hours plus, and I will tell you it was horrifying for them. And I will also tell you that in all those years and all those women, I had two that chose to get an abortion. They both chose to go out of state because of the lack of appropriate facilities here in this state. I would wish, if we were going to address this issue at all, that we talked about pregnancy prevention, ways we can eliminate unwanted pregnancies, ways we can reduce that number and thus reduce the need for abortion services at all. I would ask you to consider these things very closely. I would ask you to consider the facts and not the emotion behind this bill. And I would ask you to oppose this bill. Thank you.
Chairman Korberg.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Chairman, back to, I guess, some of the getting our facts straight on this particular piece of legislation. For all of those of you who have your statute books handy, if you would just turn to 35-6-101, the definition of viability does not have any reference to 20 to 23 weeks. So let us understand that. The definition of viability in statute right now does not reference 20 to 23 weeks. So I do not believe that our statute precludes any physician from performing an abortion in that time frame. if he determines that the definition of viability in our statute does not apply to this time period. I believe that our definition allows a physician some latitude in making that decision. So the weeks are not in the statute. So let's understand that to begin with. That's the first thing we need to be aware of. We have, as a body, we have taken a stand on this issue by the very nature that this 356-101 through whatever is in our statutes. We have made the decision to allow women to have the right to make that choice. All this piece of legislation does, and let's understand, it is an emotional issue. We've heard a lot of talk up here today. It's an emotional issue on both sides of the aisle, on both sides of the position. So what better reason, in my opinion, to put into statute a 24-hour waiting period? Because it is such an emotional decision. And we're not even the ones making. Some of us, I guess, have actually made the decision. So I think the 24-hour waiting period is appropriate. This bill does not deny a woman the right to make the choice. It just says, if you want to make this choice, the physician has to offer you the opportunity to have an ultrasound. She doesn't have to accept that opportunity. It just says he has to offer her that opportunity. And then in the case where the unborn child is 20 weeks gestation or more, he has to offer her the information on fetal pain. She does not have to accept it. I think this is a good bill. And I think by the very fact that we have this piece of legislation in our statutes, it allows us the opportunity at different times to go back and revisit that bill and make it a better bill. And that's what this piece of legislation does, in my opinion. Let's understand about the reporting requirements. There is no penalty for not reporting in the statute, the way I read it right now. And the records only have to be kept for 7 years. So I think when we talk about this process on the floor, we need to read the statute, we need to read what's in there, and we need to make a good, informed decision. This is a good, solid piece of legislation that just provides those women who are faced with making this decision an opportunity to have additional information. And we make decisions every day. Every decision we make is a broad-based decision, whether we're talking about this bill here today, whether we're going to talk about a bill about no concealed or concealed carry without a permit. We make decisions every day, broad-based decisions that affect people's lives. We made the choice to get involved in this issue when we put this statute on the books. All of us here today have every opportunity and every right to bring legislation that makes this piece of statute better. So on and in favor of this bill. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Madam Minority Whip.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. With all due respect to the good chairman of transportation, I think she's misreading the statute or perhaps misinterpreting it. 356-102 prohibits any abortion after viability. The reason the statute refers to viability is that we know viability has occurred sooner in pregnancy than originally thought. So a fixed number in the statute would actually be less protective of the fetus. So the point of not having a definition of viability is that it's defaults back to when a fetus is viable. In any abortion after the point of viability, which is defined on the handout previously referenced, is illegal in the state of Wyoming unless necessary to preserve the woman from an imminent peril that substantially endangers her life or health according to appropriate medical judgment. But that's not the end. 356-103. If for some medical reason to save the mother, you have to conform an abortion. You have to basically deliver a live baby. A physician who performs an abortion under 356102 shall not intentionally terminate the viability of the unborn infant prior to, during, or following the procedure, which means that no doctor in this state is going to perform an abortion at that point unless they can save the fetus, because it would be a crime. Thank you.
Representative Edmonds.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm sorry to get up twice, but I had to go back to this because I think the good chairman of transportation actually has it right, because the point we're discussing, particularly when we're talking about fetal pain, is that viability issue. Who determines viability, and how do we determine if a child is viable outside of the womb? That is the point here. That's the point about fetal pain, that we know. I mean, we know right now all over the country they're giving pain meds to babies 20 weeks or older. But viability may not always happen at 20 weeks. It just depends. It's a medical decision. It depends on the doctor. And most doctors, particularly when we're talking about preemies and they're trying to hold them as long as possible, one of the ways they determine viability is a procedure that the mother goes through to determine the development of the lungs. I have a hard time believing that an abortion doctor is performing a very complicated procedure to determine viability. But that's how we do it when a woman is trying to reach term so that her baby has a better chance of surviving, that's going to come premature. So the idea that we've heard said that it has something to do with weeks or, you know, it has to do with viability, and that is determined by a doctor in an industry that's driven by profit. Thank you, Mr. Speaker.
Is there any further discussion? Representative Brechtel.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Women often reach the decision for abortion because they don't really know that there is other choices. I've seen it many times. As to the question of only one provider, the world's largest organization representatives of tell me that, and they're very careful in how they word it, that there is only one advertised abortion provider in the state of Wyoming. We don't know how many abortions are actually provided in the state of Wyoming. Abortion is legal to 24 weeks. At least a month after the time that hundreds of studies indicate that they would feel pain. I'd like to respond to, there was some handouts kind of waved around. I'd like to respond to a few of the bullet points on a couple of those handouts. And I'm just going to simply respond that women should receive unbiased information. We do agree. And we're only asking that the provider make sure that she has a tiny bit of information. We, the legislature, are not preparing all the information that she would get if she says yes, that she has a right to an ultrasound if she wishes. And that's really all that he needs to ask. Much like when in grade school you needed a note from your mother to skip school. We're not really suggesting a lot here in this case here. Modern ultrasound technology is today's science. And why would the industry be afraid to encourage a mother to take a look? Informed consent is said that is already the standard. So why aren't women being offered ultrasound now? Why is there such a need for post-abortion counseling? In its 1992 Pennsylvania decision, the U.S. Supreme Court upheld 24-hour waiting period for informed consent and for safer abortions.
the premise of Roe versus Wade decision was based on the making abortion safe and legal. The 1973 decision also suggested that we really don't know when life begins. And as the years went by, we saw the window to the womb, the ultrasound, and abortion providers who provided thousands of abortions suddenly changed and became pro-life people. Some of our strongest pro-life people today were used to be the biggest providers of abortion. But this bill does not restrict anybody from obtaining an abortion. It only asks that we provide a woman with a right to just a little bit of information. More than 80% of the time, mothers choose for the life of their unborn after having seen an ultrasound. I've experienced that myself. And let me respond also regarding churches that seem to be taking supposedly a stand. What's interesting about the handout, and I did read it, I read all of the church's comments and extracted some comments that would make me suggest that these churches would not disagree with this piece of legislation. Let me just offer a few sound bites. You can look for yourself. These are difficult decisions. Abortion is tragic. We don't have the wisdom to decide for her. That we are reluctant to approve abortion. That life is sacred. That we should promote legislation for safer abortions. That these decisions involve physical, emotional, and spiritual well-being. That we affirm the sacredness of all life. That they should consider giving birth. That they should get counseling. We cannot arrive at a final answer on the question of abortion. That abortion is tragic. We grieve. That men and women should get spiritual counseling. Ladies and gentlemen, I would suggest that these are not sound bites of organizations that are standing strongly against providing information, helping women to make informed decisions. With that, Mr. Chairman, I would stand for any further questions.
Representative Shepperson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm tired of talking about it. I'm tired of hearing about it. And I know everybody else probably is too. We've had these discussions on the floor before. And so when I found out I was pregnant, I thought, you know what? I'm going to go do a little bit of research. And I went to several different organizations in the town of Casper on both sides of the aisle. And I was very pleasantly surprised with both sides. I was given so much information and so much help, not only in paper, but via counseling, via the internet, any way, shape, or form. Both sides. And to me, I was so relieved. I was so happy. So then I set about trying to find a doctor. And I went through the list of obstetricians and gynecologists and everything and interviewed because it's a big decision. And everyone that I talked to, I did not have one bad experience. Not one. And again, I just was rejuvenated. I thought, you know, maybe some of our licensure bills actually do work. I've never been a fan of licensure, but maybe they do. They're keeping the right people in the right profession, and they're doing the right things. So my point is simple. What we have works. When I go to the doctor, it is the most private thing you can imagine. I want myself, I want my husband, and I want my doctor there. And I don't want any government. The doctors don't need to be told by us. And we don't even know what the heck we're talking about. We don't even know what's in the statutes. They don't need to be told by us what we need to hand out, or what they need to hand out, and what they don't. All I'm asking is we keep government where it should be, and that's out of the doctor's office. Thank you.
Is there any further discussion? Do I hear the question? Question being called. All those in favor of Chairman Harvey's motion that when the Committee of the Whole rise to report it, do so with the recommendation that House Bill 118 do pass, please say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, no.
No.
House Bill 118 has failed. Committee of the Whole. Division being called. All those in favor, please stand. All those opposed, please stand. Having failed a standing division vote, a roll call vote is required. The chief clerk will call the roll.
Barbudo.
No.
Berger.
No.
Blake.
No.
Flickrey.
No.
Bonner.
No.
Botten.
No.
Brechtel.
Aye.
Brown.
No.
Burkhart.
Aye.
Bird.
No.
Campbell.
Aye.
Kennedy.
No.
Kennedy.
Aye.
Childers excused. Connolly.
No.
Kraft.
No.
Davison excused. Edmonds.
Aye.
Eklund.
Aye.
Esquivel.
No.
Freeman.
No.
Freeman.
No.
Gay.
Aye.
Gingery.
Aye.
Goggles excused. Greer.
No.
Green.
Aye.
Harshman.
Aye.
Harvey.
Aye.
Hunt. Illaway. Illaway. Yagi.
Aye.
Kasparic.
No.
Croker.
Aye.
Crone.
Aye.
Lockhart excused. Laux.
Aye.
Lubno.
No.
Madden.
No.
McKim.
Aye.
McComey.
No.
Miller.
Aye.
Moniz.
No.
Nicholas.
No.
Patton.
No.
Peasley.
Aye.
Pedersen.
No.
Peterson.
Aye.
Petroff. Korberg.
Aye.
Roscoe.
No.
Simlick.
Aye.
Shepperson.
No.
Stewart.
No.
Stubson.
No.
Teeters.
Aye.
Throne.
No.
Vronish.
No.
Wallace.
No.
Zwanitzer Dan.
No.
Zwanitzer Dave.
No.
Mr. Speaker.
Aye.
Illaway.
Excuse.
Illaway excused. I'm about to close the vote. Are there any changes? Are there any changes? The vote is closed, 23 ayes, 32 noes, 5 excused.
Pursuant to H.R. 10-5B, House Bill 118, having failed a roll call vote, is indefinitely postponed. Mr. Majority Floor Leader.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I move that the Committee of the Whole rise and report.
You heard the motion. All those in favor, say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, no. The motion carries.
The reading clerk will read the Committee of the Whole report.
Mr. Speaker, your Committee of the Whole, having had under consideration bills on general file, beg leave to report as follows. House Bill 138, recommended do pass. House Bill 137, amended, recommended do pass. House Bill 41, amended, and further amended, recommended do pass. Representative Lubnow moved that the Committee of the Whole rise and sit again, and the motion prevailed. House Bill 46, amended and further amended. Following a failed roll call vote, the bill is deemed indefinitely postponed. House Joint Resolution Number 5, recommended do pass. House Bill 50, amended and further amended and further amended, recommended do pass. House Bill 118, amended, following a failed roll call vote, the bill is deemed indefinitely postponed. Signed, Representative Barbuto, Chairman.
Representative Barbuto.
Mr. Speaker, I move the adoption of the Committee of the Whole report.
You've heard the motion. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, no. The Committee of the Whole report is adopted. We're at that order of business. Messages from the Senate.
Message number 137, Mr. Speaker. The bills listed below passed the Senate on third reading in an amendment form by the vote indicated. Senate file 17, ayes 30, probation and parole amendments, ayes 30, no 0. Signed, Diana Williamson, Senate Chief Clerk. Message 138, Mr. Speaker. The bills listed below passed the Senate on third reading in an amended form by the vote indicated. Senate file 39, Aquatic Invasive Species Reciprocity. Ayes 26, noes 4. Signed, Diana Williamson, Senate Chief Clerk. Message 139. Mr. Speaker, the bills listed below pass the Senate on third reading in an amended form by the vote indicated. Senate File 45, Professional Services Procurement. Ayes 30, no 0. Signed, Diana Williamson, Senate Chief Clerk. Message 140, Mr. Speaker, the bills listed below pass the Senate on third reading by the vote indicated. Senate File 54, Disability Insurance Rates Notice. Ayes 28, noes 2, signed Diana Williamson, Senate Chief Clerk. Message 141, Mr. Speaker, the bills listed below pass the Senate on third reading in an amended form by the vote indicated. Senate File 63, Game and Fish Donation of Hunting Licenses. Ayes 30, no 0. Signed, Donna Williamson, Senate Chief Clerk. Message number 142. Mr. Speaker, the bills listed below pass the Senate on third reading in an amended form by the vote indicated. Senate File 69, Revisers Bill. Ayes 30, no 0. Signed, Donna Williamson, Senate Chief Clerk. Message 143. Mr. Speaker, the bills listed below pass the Senate on third reading by the vote indicated. Senate File Number 72, Fair Practices of Equipment Act Amendment. Ayes 29, noes 1. Signed, Diana Williamson, Senate Chief Clerk. Message Number 144, Mr. Speaker, the bills listed below pass the Senate on third reading in an amended form by the vote indicated. Senate File 77, County Officers Removal from Office. Ayes 24, 06, signed Ian Williamson, Senate Chief Clerk. Message number 145. Mr. Speaker, the bills listed below pass the Senate on third reading by the vote indicated. Senate File 108, Remote Electronic Terminals Fees. Ayes 28, noes 2, signed Donna Williamson, Senate Chief Clerk. Message number 146. Mr. Speaker, the bills listed below failed to pass the Senate on third reading by the vote indicated. Senate File 84, Hospital Services Collection Rates. Ayes 12, noes 18, signed Donna Williamson, Senate Chief Clerk.
We are at that order of business, reports from standing committees.
Mr. Speaker, your committee number one, Judiciary, to whom is referred House Bill 120, respectfully reports same back to the House with recommendation that it do pass with the following amendments. Ayes, Barbuto, Brechtel, Brown, Kennedy, Green, Peasley, Throne, no, Crone, Nicholas. Signed, Representative Brown, Chairman. Mr. Speaker, your committee number one, Judiciary, to whom is referred House Bill 142, respectfully reports same back to the House with the recommendation that it do pass. Ayes, Barbuto, Brown, Kennedy, Green, Crone, Throne. No, Brechtel, Nicholas, Peasley. Signed, Representative Brechtel, Vice Chairman. Mr. Speaker, your committee number one, Judiciary, to whom is referred House Bill 157, respectfully report same back to the House with the recommendation that it do pass. Ayes, Barbuto, Brechtel, Brown, Kennedy, Green, Crone, Nicholas, Peasley, Throne. Signed, Representative Brown, Chairman. Mr. Speaker, your committee number one, Judiciary, to whom is referred House Bill 158, respectfully report same back to the House with the recommendation that it do pass. Ayes, Barbuto, Brechtel, Brown, Kennedy, Green, Crone, Throne. No, Nicholas Peasley, signed Representative Brown, Chairman. Mr. Speaker, your committee number one, Judiciary, to whom is referred House Bill 159, respectfully reports same back to the House with the recommendation that it do pass with the following amendments. Ayes, Barbuto, Brechtel, Brown, Kennedy, Green, Crone, Nicholas Peasley, Throne. Signed Representative Brown, Chairman. Mr. Speaker, your committee number two, Appropriations, to whom is referred House Bill 49, respectfully reports same back to the House with the recommendation that it do pass with the following amendments. Ayes, Berger, Edmonds, Escobel, Harshman, Pedersen, Stewart. No, Wallace. Signed, Representative Berger, Chairman. Mr. Speaker, your committee number five, Agriculture, State, and Public Lands, and Water Resources, to whom was referred House Bill 6. Respectfully report same back to the House with the recommendation that it do pass. Ayes, Blake, Camel, Eklund, Hunt, Laux, Moniz, Semlek, Zwanitzer, Dan. Excused, Davison. Signed, Representative Semlek, Chairman. Mr. Speaker, your committee number 5, Agricultural, State, and Public Lands and Water Resources, to whom was referred House Bill 16. Respectfully report same back to the House with the recommendation that it do pass with the following amendments. Ayes, Blake, Davison, Eklund, Laux, Zwanitzer, Dan. No, Camel, Hunt, Moniz, Semlek. Signed, Representative Semlek, Chairman. Mr. Speaker, your committee number 10, Labor, Health, and Social Services, to whom was referred House Bill 39. Respectfully report same back to the House with the recommendation that it do pass. Ayes, Gay, Green, Harvey, Hunt, Miller, Peasley. No, Barbuto, Kraft, Gingrey. Signed, Representative Miller, Vice Chairman. Mr. Speaker, your committee number 10, Labor, Health, and Social Services, to whom is referred House Bill 106. Respectfully report same back to the House with the recommendation that it do pass with the following amendments. Ayes, Barbuto, Kraft, Gay, Gingrey, Green, Harvey, Hunt, Miller, Beasley. Signed, Representative Harvey, Chairman.
Representative Gingrey.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. Pursuant to Rule 24-12A, having voted on the prevailing side, I'm giving notice of my intention to move to reconsider House Bill 31, Paramutual Regulation, tomorrow, January 26th, after the third reading.
Thank you. Re-referrals of bills, Chairman Harvey.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'd like to re-refer House Bill 39 to your committee number 2, Appropriations.
Been moved for a re-referral of House Bill 39 to committee number 2, Appropriations. Hearing no objection, it is so ordered. Chairman Simlick.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. I request House Bill 66 be re-referred to committee number 2, Appropriations, as it has a appropriation transfer. Thank you, Mr. Speaker.
Been moved that House Bill 66 be referred to committee number 2, Appropriations. Hearing no objection, it is so ordered. We were at that order of business of birthday salutations to a very special staff member today. And I'd like you to all stand for me and help me celebrate Pam Landry's 36th birthday today. And we've got a gift for her. She takes very good care of us. She bakes cookies for our meetings and makes a salad so we have a well-rounded meal when we have our luncheons, and goes above the call of duty for everything we ask her to do. So, Pam, come on out here.
And many more.
We won't make her make a speech, but thank you, Pam, for all your hard work on behalf of the legislature. Committee announcements.
Mr. Speaker.
Chairman McComey.
Oh, thank you, Mr. Speaker. Your committee number 6, travel. We'll meet Wednesday morning at 8 a.m. in room H10, which is tomorrow, where we will take up Joint House Resolution, Private Property Protection, and House Bill 47, State Park User Fee Program that was continued from January 19th.
Chairman Korberg.
Well, thank you, Mr. Speaker. Mr. Speaker, your committee number 8. Transportation and Military Affairs will meet today, 10 minutes after adjournment, in room H-17 to hear House Bill 154, Multiple Special Handicapped License Plates, and House Bill 77, Disabled Veterans License Plate Handicapped Parking.
Chairman Brown.
Mr. Speaker, your committee number 1, Judiciary, will meet tomorrow, January 26th at 6:59 a.m. in room H-8 to consider the following bills. House Bill 122, No Duty to Retreat. House Bill 167, Castle Doctrine Modifications. House Bill 141, Governmental Immunity, Waiver for Hospital Employees. House Bill 160, Management Audit Committee Subpoena Power. House Bill 170, Conservation Easements Notification. And House Joint Resolution 4, Repeal of 17th Amendment.
Vice Chairman Stubson.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. Your committee number 9, Minerals, will meet tomorrow morning at 8 a.m. in room H-18 to discuss the following bills. House Bill 114, Insurance Premiums Failure to Pay. House Bill 129, Nuclear Energy Production Study. And House Bill 48, Placement of Wind Energy Facilities.
Chairman Berger.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I was wondering, is there a limit of bills that I can take in appropriations too? On those re-referrals. But anyway, Mr. Chairman, we will be hearing tomorrow morning bright and early at 8 o'clock your Appropriations Committee 2, House Bill 127, School Finance Recalibration, and if there is time allowed, any other re-referred bills that we can do. Thank you.
Chairman Dubois? No, just kidding. Vice Chairman Miller.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. Your Committee Number 3, Revenue, will meet tomorrow morning, Wednesday, January 26th at 8 a.m. in room H-11 to consider the following bills. House Bill 104, Property Tax Sales, Highest Bidder. House Bill 83, Veterans Property Tax Exemption, House Bill 145, Vehicle Registration Timing, and House Bill 146, Vehicle Sales and Use Tax.
Chairman Harvey.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. Your committee number 10 will meet tomorrow, January 26th, 15 minutes upon adjournment, in room H-17 to hear the following bills. House Bill 103, WICHE Repayment Program. House Bill 99, Substance Abuse Treatment Funding Awards. House Bill 36, Cancer Control and Act Amendments. House Bill 162, OSHA Rule Reviews.
Chairman Teeters.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. Your committee number for education will meet Wednesday, January 26th upon adjournment in H-10 for consideration of the following bills. House Bill 85, Teacher Suspension. House Bill 182, Student Assessment Measures. And House Bill 155, Student Assessment Amendments.
Mr. Majority Floor Leader, that clears the desk.
Thank you. Good work today, ladies and gentlemen. You did a marvelous job. General file has swollen a little bit. The bills to be considered tomorrow will be House Bill 63, House Bill 23, House Bill 5, House Bill 115, House Bill 52, House Bill 106, House Bill 124, House Bill 49, in a trio of the most exciting bills in the history of the legislature all in a row, House Bill 157, Abolition of the Doctrine of Worthier Title, House Bill 158, The Rule Against Perpetuities, House Bill 159, The Uniform Trust Code Amendments, and House Bill 16, House Bill 6, House Bill 82, House Bill 142, House Bill 10, House Bill 22, House Bill 35, House Bill 121, and House Bill 120. With that, Mr.
Hold off on your motion there for just 1 second, Mr. Majority Floor Leader. Tonight, our University of Wyoming Cowboys take on UNLV. So we have Representative Blakes and Barbudo once again with the ukulele.
I was told by some of the staff out there that we were pretty lethargic and not very enthusiastic in our singing and clapping this year. So the Cowboys need our help, so let's sing enthusiastically, please.
Majority Floor Leader.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. I move that the House adjourn until 10 a.m. tomorrow, Wednesday, January 26, 2011.
You've heard the motion. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, no. The House is adjourned until January 26, Wednesday, 2011, 10 a.m.